floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas, and welcome to another episode of Walking the Floor with me, Chris Shiflett. As always, we are brought to you by Floyd's 99 Barbershops. Floyd's 99 Barbershops, they're everywhere. So what are you waiting for? Go get your haircut. Floyd's 99. Okay, I'm sitting in my office at home. It is a perfect California December day. I've got a big hot cup of coffee, and I am really far away from the madness of touring, which probably most of you know. The Foo Fighters touring cycle for Sonic Highways has officially come to an end, and we are all working our way back into civilian life, which feels pretty darn good. It was a bummer that we had to end the last tour, the last leg, on such a sad note after the attacks in Paris. We had to cancel the last few shows, but you know, all in all, it's been quite a couple of years, and it's really nice to be home for the holidays. But it is weird to have all this time on my hands after being so busy for so long. No day sheet, no show, no sound check, none of that stuff. But I tell you what, I do have a brand new half pipe in my yard, courtesy of my new friends at OC Ramps that put that in there for me yesterday. So I'm going to learn how to skate again. I haven't been on a half pipe since the mid 80s. But me and my kids are going to figure this thing out. I want you to know I had my first full blown body slam this afternoon trying to figure out how to skate again. So I'll keep you apprised of the situation. Anywho, let's move on to my interview with Rhett Miller, who I would describe as an absurdly prolific songwriter, as well as, you know, being a singer, frontman, guitar player for Dallas, Texas alt-country band, the Old 97s. He's also got a ton of solo records, and he's just great. He's just a smart, cool guy. It was really, really fun to talk to him. We talked about his history of how he got into music and growing up and how the Old 97s came to be. And not only that, but he also, if you listen far enough into this interview, he gives you out a great suggested reading list, and we get into his songwriting process, and he even decodes the mystery of how John Bryan played the guitar solo on Our Love off his first solo record. So despite the fact that my mic dies about halfway through the interview, and we both played gigs up in San Francisco the night before, and I think we were probably both pretty tired, we had a great talk. So let's get to it. This is Rhett Miller on Walking the Floor.
Well, I married Caroline back in May of 99. It was fucked up at the time, but I figured we'd keep trying. Her brother and her dad, they were spitting mad when I packed up what I had and took off running. It was bad. It was mean. I didn't care.
Or are you, you're probably in the same sort of frame of mind that I'm in. Like, you guys played last night, right? Are you yeah. Burnt? Have you been touring a lot?
Yeah, we're on like day 9 of a 3-week run.
Oh, okay.
And the kids just started school. I got to be home for like the first week and a half of their school, and so
right.
Helped the transition and everything.
Yeah.
But man, you miss them. How old are yours?
Mine are, well, my oldest is about to turn 12.
Oh, nice.
And then I've got a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old.
That's exactly. I've got a boy about to turn 12 in November and a 9-year-old girl.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So, you know.
So sweet.
I mean, you know, I've been gone for most of the summer and then all of the school year so far, even though it just kind of started a couple weeks ago. But it's definitely my wife's like, all right, you're home for a couple days. Later. Have fun.
Exactly.
Yeah, but, you know, that's what you got to do. So yeah, how was your gig last night? How was the Fillmore?
It was great, and I was a little worried because it's off cycle. You know, it's been a year since the record came out.
Has it been that long?
Yeah, it was. It's been about maybe over a year since the record came out.
I sort of had it in my mind that Old 97s had taken like a hiatus for a bit.
No,
but I think the reason, because I was looking, you know, getting ready to interview you, and I was looking at like all your record releases and looking at the dates and everything, and I was like, okay, no, that didn't appear to happen. But I think maybe I had that in my head just because you've put out so many solo records.
Yeah,
as
I've been
well.
Alternating since like 01. I've been alternating solo records between each 97s release. One that we did too, Grand Theater Volume 1 and 2. I didn't put out a solo record between those two, but that was sort of one.
Did you guys record those records at the same time and then just put them out separately? Was it one
Mostly.
Of those kind of deals?
It was going to be a double album, and then the record label didn't want to do that. And so we went back in and added a couple of extra songs and put out Volume 2. It was mostly done in the same session as Volume 1.
I mean, you've had such an enormous output in the last whatever it's been, you know, maybe since you started doing solo records, 10, 15 years or so?
Yeah, I made The Instigator with John Bryan in 01, the beginning of 02, I guess.
I mean, are you just the most prolific human being in the business? Like, how do you find the time to write so many damn songs? It's crazy.
I don't feel like that. I love to be around. One reason I love coming on tour in the West Coast is I love being around people, like really creative people. And I live now in the country, and there's some really cool, smart people up there, and even some really great, you know, writers and some musicians.
In Texas?
I live now in the Hudson Valley, just north of Manhattan.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Weirdly, I just kind of wound up there, and I love it. But it's, you know, it's where my kids have always been, and it's a great place to raise kids. And I miss my Texas family, but I love living there. But I love coming out here because, like, yesterday I got to have lunch with Michael Chabon and his wife, Ayelet at Waldman, and they're both these novelists that are really great. And so, you know, we're having lunch talking about, the creative process and the voices in your head and how hard it is to shut them down or ignore them or you know, just all the – and even just, like, the nuts and bolts of writing. And I love stuff like that. And, you know, in L.A. and San Francisco, you're going to find more people – that do that for a living and think about that all the time than you are in, you know, New Paltz, New York.
But are you the type of writer that writes all the time? Are you able to write while you're, I mean, you guys tour so much that you must be writing presumably on the road as well as at home.
And I'm such an idiot. We'd been off the road we'd played every Saturday in August, but the rest of the month was 6 days a week I was off, and it was great. I got to be with the kids and all that after the summer. So I was a little bit out of shape, and so we got on this this run, and a week in we had our first day off, and I could tell, like, after Seattle and Portland, I blew it out a little, and my voice was just at the edge of not wanting to work well. And so I thought, well, at least I got a day off. But then I got excited, and the guy that's opening for us has produced records for us, Salim Nirala, is this great guy, and we've been writing songs together. So he's like, hey, you want to write a song? So I spent 6 hours writing a song with him, and the next day I got all excited and spent 6 hours recording demos of new songs. And we got to the gig the next night on our first night back, and my voice was worse than it had been before the day off. I'm such an idiot.
It's funny, man, when you're the singer of your band, like, you're on a different tour than everybody else. Your tour is the constant perpetual fear of losing your voice. You know.
And then the irony, or the added insult to the, is that you have to do the press. So, you know, you're the one that's always talking and talking and talking, which is, I think they
say. The press
say
and the small talk, which I don't think people realize how much of, like, what we do for a living is, like, technically you get paid to play music or whatever, but really you get paid to small talk.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's pretty much your job.
Like you said, you guys had a private or a corporate gig last night.
And
those can be the worst. I mean, and maybe once you're at a certain point, they're just happy that you walk on the stage, play your songs, and walk off. But for, like, me, I'm at a level where if I do a corporate, it's mostly about the small talk. It's mostly them paying me to not mind that they're talking while I'm singing, and then I'm talking to the CEO for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah, sure.
You know? And I'm grateful for it. Believe me, that's good money in those corporate gigs.
I feel like those gigs are sometimes the most fun, though, because there's no pressure.
Yeah.
And it's like an office party. You know, it's a room full of drunk, you know, executive type people generally, you know, when you go out and do those things, and, like, you know, their ties are up around their heads and they're, like, cutting it loose, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you guys did not take a break in old 97s.
There was a window when it was funny. It was right around the beginning of the new millennium when we had put out our third record for Elektra. Elektra was on the brink of, you know, they'd done there was the Time Warner merger. They were on the brink of sort of folding, collapsing, becoming a catalog company or whatever.
Right.
And Elektra wanted to put out this, as I'd had a bunch of songs the 97s didn't want. And I thought they were really good. And I'd gotten permission to do a solo record. And Elektra got excited about that.
Mm.
And so they wanted to put that record out. There was a tense moment in the band. I say moment. It was probably like three quarters of a year.
Yeah.
Where we weren't positive that it was going to, that we could keep it going. You know?
Right, right.
And so when I did The Instigator and then the year after that, there was like a 2 or 3 year window where I don't know that the 97s did a lot. So our biggest gap was in between our Electra portion of our catalog, and then we went to New West after that. So there was
a little.
But during that time, I put out a solo record, and then ever since then, it's been about a year and a half between records.
So you just said that you had a batch of songs that the old 97s did not want to do. So is that kind of
why I do these solo records? Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I give them first crack at any song, even though these days I feel like I have a pretty good idea what they're going to like or not, and then they'll still surprise me.
Right.
But they're the one that brung me to the dance or whatever.
Right.
They're my number one. So I give them first crack, and then there's always tons of songs that they don't want that I feel like are good. And so if I didn't have the solo career as an outlet, I'd go nuts.
I mean, I was going to ask you what your process was of deciding what goes to what, but I mean, you just answered it. But are there ever times that you write something specifically and you just know, like, that's not going to be an old 97 song? Like, we can't do that. We can't dilute the sound or the brand or what with this thing?
No, I mean, it's funny, because you've probably experienced this. In a band, everybody's got different jobs within the dynamic of that band. Like, you know, my bass player, Murray, and this is totally oversimplifying, but his job is to keep things real. You know, we got to keep it as close to the, you know, Carter family or whatever as we can.
Right.
And Ken, his job is that we got to keep it big and dumb and rocking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if we start, you know, flirting with, I remember, you know, years ago, I'd fallen in love with a Belle and Sebastian record, and I was taking it to the guys going, this is it.
This is the sound, man.
And he's like, are you kidding? This is the opposite. So there's that push and pull. And so my influence on the band has usually been to try and push us towards kind of, and this is, again, dumbing it down, but kind of prettier stuff. Like, I really love melody. I really love something that's got kind of
like
a
pop hooks.
Heart. Yeah, pop, big time. And so I write these songs, and I really hope the band would be interested in doing them, and sometimes they are.
Mm.
And invariably, that song that's super pretty when I write it will become bigger and bigger and weirder and noisier and become an old 97 song.
Right.
But then there was a song a few years ago I had called Another Girlfriend, and it was just a dumb country song. And it was just like, you know, last thing I need is another girlfriend. Two's enough for me. You know, it was just,
right.
I thought for sure, like, there's never been a more old 97 song. And I brought it to them, and they're like, nah, I don't know. I don't get it.
Right.
So I put it on a solo record, and it was just – and that's the irony now. The 97s have become a garage band, and my solo records have gotten to be now more kind of rootsy and pretty,
right.
And I get pedal steel and fiddle and the kind of stuff that used to be sort of a touchstone of the 97 sound. Now we're more like a, you know, underground garage kind of rock band.
That's interesting. It's like kind of like your solo – records and your old 97 stuff have flip-flopped.
A little bit, yeah. But I think at its heart, the 97s has always been a garage band. You
right.
know? It used to be that we just weren't as maybe as good as at our instruments. Or,
right.
You know, we didn't appreciate volume like we do now.
Like what were the things, like, what were you listening to growing up? What were your early influences or bands that sort of got you hooked on music?
My parents were kind of dorky, folky people. So they took me to see the Kingston Trio when I was really young.
Really?
Yeah, super square kind of, you know, like really highly literate folk music.
Right. Were they like academics or something?
Yeah, for sure.
And really?
It was kind of that. They were like the squares in the beatnik crowd, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones that didn't smoke weed probably,
right.
but still hung out on campus or whatever.
Right.
And but their harmonies were incredible, just so precise.
Sure.
And they really had this encyclopedic knowledge of all kinds of music, and they'd pull all kinds of, you know, calypso and old, you know, kind of roots, like old-time American music. And so I really loved that. And their between-song banter was so intelligent. Like, it really spoke to me on these live records I would listen to. And they would make these speeches that were just so erudite, you know? And I was like, there's something really weird about, you know, they're singing Scotch and Soda, which is just this drunken ballad, but they're singing it so tight and beautiful and perfect, and then they're making this speech in between. So I kind of fell in love with that, and then I got into Bowie.
Mm.
Like, Bowie was really big for me when I was little, like 13. I got to go see him on the Serious Moonlight Tour. And
really?
I was dating the younger sister of Lisa Loeb, the singer from Dallas. And
what, at the time?
I was dating, yeah, Debbie was Lisa's younger sister. And Lisa at the time was just, you know, a couple of years ahead of us in school. And
right.
She was already playing music and stuff. And I was just learning to play guitar. And Debbie took, Lisa took Debbie and I to see David Bowie. And we sat at Reunion Arena. And we were off to the side of the stage. And he had this moment where, you know, the Serious Moonlight Tour was pretty great. I mean, that record was considered, actually in retrospect, I think people appreciate it for what it was. But at the time, most Bowie fans thought it was a huge sellout.
Right.
You know, and it was, but it worked. Yeah. So
Was that Let's Dance? Was that
yeah,
tour?
It was that record. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's Stevie Ray Vaughan playing. That's like, you know, exactly. Some of the best lead work that guy ever did. Amazing.
Yeah, incredible. And so he comes off stage before the encore, Bowie does, and the band's all gone off stage right, and he comes off stage left, and there's this just little staircase, and somebody walks up to him with a platter, and on it there's a folded-up towel, and there's like a cup of tea, and there's a lit cigarette in an ashtray, and there's 20,000 people, and they're chanting, Bowie, Bowie, and he mops his forehead, and he kind of loosens his tie, and he sips the tea, and he takes a few drags off the cigarette, and there was just... It was like the most intimate moment. And from our vantage point where we were sitting on the side of the stage, I could see it so clearly. It was like something about it really focused the humanity of that moment for him. Like, he is just a person, and he's listening to all these people chant, and they all think he's something bigger than what he is, or something, you know, mythical, or something, you know, godlike. And he's just a person, and he wants to get rid of some of the sweat, take a sip of tea, drag off a cigarette, you know, and then he'll go back out and give them more. And it really is giving. I think about that a lot, especially on nights when it's hard, you know. Mm-hmm. You're giving something, and that's okay. I know it's not. I used to have a girlfriend that would say, well, you're not curing cancer, you know, and I'm like, well, you're right. But it is. There is a nobility to what we do. You know, we are giving something to a world that needs as much beauty as it can get, you know. And so there was
funny. I think about that sometimes. I was thinking about that on stage the other night. And it's sort of related to that, is that it's not your choice how people react, you know, to your music, like in terms of like celebrating it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a funny thing when you look out at the crowd, and sometimes, you know, performing is a weird thing where you get it in your head, oh, these people hate us, or what? they're not going crazy enough, or what? You know what I mean? Like, and you'll have it, and that can like sink a show for you if you don't get over it and remember that's, you know, you're standing in front of a room full of people, and they're there to see you, and they want you to do well, and they want to enjoy it. They're like rooting for you. You know, nobody's there to shoot you down.
But at that moment, it's really hard to get past it. It's like, well, it's the novelist I ate with yesterday talking about that voice in your head that's like, you're no good.
Yeah.
People don't want to hear this.
Yeah.
You're fat. Whatever. Just these voices, and they're just saying these things to you. So yeah, but no, it's hard on stage. And it's funny. Of course, you would have the same experience I have, that even though the crowds are bigger and whatever, it's like you're just a person on stage. And
sure.
And sometimes it's hard not to think of, oh my God, I'm going to wake up at my house tomorrow. I'm thinking about my kids, or I'm thinking about making a grocery list, or I'm thinking, you know, your mind could be in a million places.
Totally.
And also on what you're doing. You know? But
there was a guy right off the stage from me the other night up in Mountain View. I look over him, and he's screaming at me really aggressively and with two middle fingers up. Give me that one, give me that. And my reaction was like, whoa, what, am I like ruining that guy's night? So I'm like, what did I do? And then it took me a second. I looked at him and I realized, oh, he's just having a good time. And that's like his way of expressing
he's
it. Like,
super
he
excited.
Wasn't angry. He was like, yeah, but that's how he did it, you know?
Yeah, it's funny. You got to talk yourself down from those moments.
Totally, totally. How did, was there a point for you where you sort of like started rejecting your parents' record collection, you know, things like the Kingston Trio? What was your path to rock and roll? Was it, you know, punk rock or heavy metal? Like how did you get there?
God, with my parents, I never felt like I rejected them very much. I kind of stopped having a lot to do with them pretty early. Like, I appreciated what they gave me with the Kingston Trio and obviously the Beatles, and they introduced me to a lot of stuff. You know, one thing my mom did that I loved was she instilled in me a real love of choir, of singing in a choir. Mm-hmm.
And did you do that when you were
young? I did. I wasn't religious really, but I was a I was an altar boy. I was in church, you know, every Sunday and Wednesday, because I loved singing in the choir, and I loved this experience of being a part of something larger. You know, like we're all singing at once, and any one of us singing would be pretty, would be nice.
Yeah.
But all of us singing at once, it becomes this transcendent thing.
Right.
And so I really loved that. I was glad she gave me that. But, you know, they start, my folks started having tough times when I don't know, probably when I was like 10. Mm. And so they were, it was, Robin Hitchcock has a line in a song where and it rained like a slow divorce. You know, my parents took a long time to split up. And so they were kind of dealing with their own thing. And I had a couple of younger siblings that I really love. And so I was focusing on kind of helping them. And then I was feeling my own feelings, you know.
Yeah.
I see my daughter now. She's a lot like I am. A lot of feelings, a lot of really strong stuff. And I think a lot of creative people wind up with that or coming from that place because you're working it out, you know. And
right.
So for me, around 13, I figured out, okay, I started taking guitar lessons at 12. It sucked. I hated it. I knew I couldn't play scales. You know, I'm not like a lead guitar player. And it might hurt my fingers. But at 13, I was like, all right, the only thing I want to do, the only thing that makes sense to me to figure out this is writing songs, and to do that, I at least have to play these open chords. So I, you know, I really hunkered down. I learned my G, C, D, A minor.
All your root position stuff.
All my, I'm still primarily a root position player.
Yeah,
like on 90% of my stuff, and that's fine. I now know diminished chords.
Yeah, so that's good. Next, throw an augmented in there, and you've got it. You've got everything you need.
My new song I wrote a couple of days ago. It's got a beautiful augmented.
Oh, nice.
Right
there you go.
But yeah, so. So for me, it was there was a radio show in Dallas called Rock and Roll Alternative that George Gamark did. And I mean, anybody my age from Dallas is going to point to that as what gave them their taste in music. And so, you know, he was introducing us to Echo and the Bunnymen and the Smiths. And I remember when I was 15 years old, on my 15th birthday, I got to go see the Smiths play at the Bronco Bowl. And they had Frank open up, who's the Southern California Jewish lesbian folk singer.
Frank, you'll appreciate this. When my kids were really young, my wife took them to this music class. Or it was my oldest at the time. He was a baby. And my wife came back and was like, oh, there's this really cool woman. Her name's Frank. And she teaches this music class.
No
I was like,
way.
Frank, does she have a flat top? And she was like, yeah, you know, she is. I'm like, are you kidding? You're taking my baby's taking music class from Frank?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Was it one of those, like,
she's here in L.A.
Music together or one
of those? Like, you know, like a mommy and me group. But, you know, she would sing songs and stuff and the kids would, you know, shake tambourines or whatever. Yeah,
oh,
it was great.
God, I love that.
Yeah.
But that was another moment. It was not far removed from me from the Bowie moment.
So you saw the Smiths at a bowling alley?
The Bronco Bowl, yeah, it technically was a bowling alley. But at the time, it was where R.E.M. went through on that tour.
Right.
It was the big, it was probably like a 5K cap, something like that.
Mm.
So, but Frank went out and opened up, and I was really beginning to write songs and play, you know. I wound up doing solo music through my teens in Dallas, and I'd open for Chris Isaak right before his Wicked Games broke.
Really?
I opened for Lords of the New Church when they came through.
Wow.
When Frank Black came through in between Pixies tours on a solo tour, I opened for him. You know, it was like, so I was...
You were pretty seasoned before Old 97s ever got together. When did Old 97s start? Like, how old were you?
I was 23, really, when we started. And so I'd been doing gigs for 8 years before that.
Oh, wow.
Opening for New Bohemians were from Dallas. I'd open every Saturday for them. And,
right.
You know, with the 500 Cafe. But there was a thing with Frank where she got out, and it was just her and a guitar in front of 5,000 people who weren't there to see her. And she won them over. And with, you know, her quirky songs, you know, Gin Ginny, or whatever like that, you know, Real Live Lesbian, her funny folk songs. And then the moment that slayed everyone was she did The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, the Dylan tune.
Mm.
And it's an all-time great song. You know, it's about injustice, it's about all the stuff, and it's really just, it just keeps moving and moving and moving, and it's very propulsive. And she got out there and did it. And I remember during that song going like, yes, okay, yes, it all makes sense. I see how I can do the thing that I was watching Bowie do, where he was doing something that I couldn't even imagine. Like, how am I going to get Carlos Alomar and, you know, the Sales Brothers and all these people, dancers and this, you know, like, that's incomprehensible to me. But I can imagine standing up there with an acoustic guitar and doing what she's doing. And so for the next 8 years, that's pretty much what I did.
Mm.
And then with the 97s, it just made sense to try and make it a little bigger.
Were those guys, like, did you know them from around the sort of Dallas music scene?
Murray was my mentor. Murray was like a 21-year-old when I was 15 and taught me to smoke weed for the first time. Taught me
That's
to
a
write
good mentor.
Songs. Yeah. Made my first demos.
Right. And, oh, really?
Yeah. Murray was good. But he was singing in a band called Peyote Cowboys. And he was, you know, the lead singer in this three-piece super psychedelic band. And they'd open for the Buttholes and they'd open for, you know, Flaming Lips and whoever came through.
I know that Texas has like a sort of an insular country music scene. Is it the same way with like rock and roll bands, like bands that, you know, that there's like a Texas circuit for country bands, you know, bands that can kind of just exist in that area.
The Red Dirt Circuit. That's
like, totally. Yeah. Like, and the whole dance hall sort of culture that exists, or at least used to exist. I don't know if it still does, but
yeah.
Is it like that for like, you know, rock and roll bands, alternative bands, whatever?
My experience has been no. I think that that's a really strong thing still for the Red Dirt crowd. Mm-hmm. It's funny, there's a record that comes out today, the day we're taping this, by a band called the Turnpike Troubadours, and they're from Oklahoma. And they've spent the last number of years primarily on that Red Dirt circuit. Mm-hmm. But they're so much better than that. And that's the problem, is when you get in something like that, it can be really reductive, and it can be really exclusive, and I think it can keep bands from, I mean, whatever. I mean, it's great for them, but right. But I think it probably can keep a band from growing if that's the end of their world, is that circuit from Oklahoma through Texas to maybe some in Louisiana.
Well, how long was it for you guys before you started playing outside and, you know, touring? And
that's what it was for us. It was, we went to Chicago. Like, we've been doing the thing where you play every week in your hometown.
Right.
And that's fine. It's a good way to, you know, get get your chops or whatever. But I went on tour with a band called Killbilly, and we did a national tour. And I was just the pickup second guitarist. I think they wanted somebody young in the band. And I've got a strong right arm. I can strum really, really fast, bluegrass style. So I just stood on the side of the stage, being 10 years younger than all of them, and strumming really fast. And, I earned my $15 a day or whatever they paid me. But I met...
Is that your introduction to per diem?
Yeah, yeah. Right. I remember it was during that tour I read Rivers Cuomo quote in Rolling Stone. They said, oh, yeah, per diem, that's Latin for $20 a day. And I remember taking it to the drummer, who was also the tour manager, and saying, I thought per diem was only $10 a day.
Yeah, where's my raise? Yeah. You're shorting me.
So we went through Chicago, and I met the folks that do Bloodshot Records there.
I just interviewed them not too long ago.
Oh, yeah, cool.
About a year ago.
Robin Nan, probably? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And Robbie Foulkes, too. I interviewed
I
him
love
at
Robbie.
Bloodshot.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
But so Nan really liked me, liked the record I gave her of our first record that we'd made in Dallas, mm. Hitchhike to Rome. And so they brought us up to do, you know, we'd drive up to Chicago for one-offs. We'd like, we've got the Blasters coming through the double door. Do you want to open for them for $50? Sure, we'll drive, you know, whatever, 12
drive
hours.
Drive from Dallas to
Chicago.
That's a pretty long schlep. Were you doing shows along the way?
We'd pick up a St. Louis maybe.
Right.
But I remember on that Blasters gig, we just drove there, did the Blasters gig. But it was worth it because we built a Chicago fan base before we even made our Bloodshot record there. We did one record for Bloodshot, and we already had a fan base where we could go fill up the double door and the empty bottle, and I guess empty bottle first, then the double door. And Chicago was the market where we first broke through, and then we came back to Dallas, and we had these stories of having sold out real rock clubs in Chicago.
Right.
And suddenly everybody in Dallas was like, well, all along we've loved you guys, of course. You know. So then suddenly we're like hometown heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
We had to go somewhere else to earn it.
I mean, how long did it take, and I don't know exactly the timeline, if this was all happening at the same time, but how long did it take for you guys to sort of connect with other like-minded bands? Like, I would think, like, what, like Whiskey Town or Uncle Tupelo, or maybe at the time that had become Sunvolt Wilco. And, you know, just the sort of bands that are associated with the sort of early alt country or alternative or whatever you call it kind of scene. How long did it take for you guys to connect with or did you ever connect with them?
We did.
Did you feel like, was there like a camaraderie, like did you, with like-minded bands, I guess is my question.
Well, it was so much of it for us was around Bloodshot, but at the time that was a lot. When we first put out our Bloodshot record, we got on a No Depression tour, and we'd met Ryan years before from Whiskey Town when he did a solo gig opening for us in North Carolina, and he was such a sweet little kid, which is so funny now to see who he is now. But at the time, he was just such a sweet little positive, fresh-faced, excited guy. And then we did a No Depression tour with Whiskey Town, and
you two could probably compete for like most prolific songwriter in current scene.
I don't want to compete with anybody, but yeah. So that scene was really fun at the time. I mean, Robbie Foulkes was a big one. John Lankford, you know. And again, these are mostly people that were on Bloodshot at the time.
Right.
But at the time, really, Bloodshot was the epicenter of. You know, I remember there was this moment where they were trying to figure out what's it going to be called. And there was a push. Bloodshot kept wanting to call it Insurgent Country. And then there was one guy called it Yalternative. There was another guy that kept trying to call it Honky Skronk, which we were like, dude, I will quit.
Not start that.
I'll get a job. I'll go get a job. I'll sell insurance if that's right. What this shit is called.
Yeah.
So, I guess when Alt Country came along, I was like, ah, fine. It's at the time, it bothered me because it seemed reductive.
Nobody ever wants a label.
Yeah.
Now, of course.
Yeah, because then I remember our first Rolling Stone review was Grant Alden. I'm such a jerk that I still remember this. Grant Alden, who was one of the editors of No Depression, reviewed Too Far to Care, our first Elektra record for Rolling Stone. And the whole gist of the review was, this is not country enough. This is too loud, and it's not country enough. And I'm like... According to whom? When did you join my band? When did you get a vote, dude?
Right. Well, that's an interesting question, or an interesting thought. Like, how much country do you think alt country bands were listening to? Because it's funny. That's when I sort of discovered. Like, I didn't grow up listening to country music. No. You know, I grew up listening to heavy metal and punk rock and stuff, and then got into. Like your band and Whiskey Town and Sunbolt and all those bands around the same time through a friend of mine that I was in a band with. And I'd always sort of liked rockabilly and old rockabilly, like Gene Vincent and Eddie Cochran and stuff like that. So through bands like yours, I sort of, followed the influences back and got into like Buck Owens and
Hank Sr.,
Merle Haggard and, stuff like that. And so now when I listen to a lot of, quote unquote, alt country bands, like to me, it almost sounds like they were listening to more like Stones or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you can hear the country, but do you think that was as big an influence on the No Depression scene as people want to believe? You know what I mean? Like, because it's a lot of it is just, it's like more kind of rock and roll in a
it's
way.
It's super rare for a kid to grow up being really into Waylon and Hank Sr.
Right.
And I mean, almost everybody comes at it through, like, and it's weird for Murray, our bass player, who was really a big driving force, but behind sort of the sound and idea of the old 97s, and he named the band and all that. For Murray, he was writing punk rock fanzines. He was going to Dead Kennedy shows and having Jello Biafra sleep on his couch. He was a punk rocker. And then he started taking acid and got into psychedelic music. And then it all sort of led him back. It's sort of what you're saying. You follow it back. And then it was all about the Carter Family. And then when you hit that stuff, it's kind of like the mother load. You're like...
Totally.
Oh, okay.
And it's a bottomless pit, too.
Yes.
Because all those bands recorded, millions of songs.
Oh, and he had these horrible jobs, and he would save up every penny and then go buy a box set. And he would not eat food. He'd eat ramen noodles every night, but he'd be owning every box set available for the Carter Family and Johnny Cash and all this stuff. And so I think most of those bands would have come from a place where they were way more familiar with the Rolling Stones before they ever really understood the old, the influences from way back. And for me, I was an Anglophile. It was all about Aztec Camera. And, I made a record in high school, and I'm really glad that it's out of print because it's so rare for anything to be unavailable anymore.
Right.
But I have a British accent on the whole record. Just as I thought
really?
That's how you sing.
Right.
Well, when you go into the studio, that's what you do, right?
Of course. Yeah. Why not?
So it was for me. It was definitely, I was coming at it from I'm a seventh generation Texan who was so into British music that I had to learn, way late in life about, except for Buddy Holly. Like for me, Buddy Holly was at a really early age. I connected with him super strongly. And then when I kind of went back around, I was like, oh, he's doing a tamer 50s, early 60s, whatever version of the country music, rock and roll version of the country music. And I really love that.
They're so closely related.
Yeah.
I mean, if you listen to the country records from 1956, 57, 58, they're pretty much the same thing. It's like rockabilly. It's like maybe a little faster and
all
less
of it
pedal
is.
Steel or
and,
whatever.
And that's what the alt country thing. The thing that ruined it, if you're going to say something ruined it, was those bands that would bring bales of hay out on stage and they'd wear right. overalls or whatever, right, you know, and you know, have the corn stalk and the thing sticking out of their teeth. And
right.
And we had one band, I remember, in North Carolina in Chapel Hill at Cat's Cradle that opened for us on one of our first tours. And we had a good buzz about us, but we were a punk rock band that had country influences.
Right,
and
sure.
And I think that's part of what people liked about us was, you know, it just, so we'd go there and this band opened up for us and they were up there with all their shtick and all their, you know, affectations. And the lead singer at one point goes, "This next song's called Two Turds and a Golf Ball." And so thereafter, whenever we'd encounter one of those bands, we'd be like, "Oh, great, it's Two Turds and a Golf Ball."
Right. Well, sort of what, let's look at the polar opposite of that. What are the great, like, unsung bands of that time that I wouldn't know about? Bands that maybe never made records or, you know, that you were around, you know? Are there some bands that, like, should have gotten to that next stage documenting their thing and just kind of never did?
Yeah, there was a band, and again, so much of it goes back to presentation, and I think that this is probably true for any band, or really maybe any creator of art. There was a band from Arizona called Earl Whitehead and the Grievous Angels. Earl Whitehead was the name of a character from Deliverance, and the Grievous Angels is obviously a reference to, you know, Graham.
Sure.
So it's like they were a band with so many of the trimmings hanging off their name that you're like, okay, wait, what's going on? You know, how about, so, I mean, this is coming from a guy whose band is named after a Johnny Cash song. So, I mean, clearly I'm, you know, we're treading a fine line here.
Yeah.
But it was a great band. It was a really great band with great songs. And they've all, you know, kind of gone on to do some interesting stuff. Most notably, perhaps, John Rawhouse, their pedal steel player, has been playing with Nico Case for the last 20 years and does a lot of stuff, and he's done session work on a bunch of records, including old 97s. And so that was a band that we loved and had a lot of fun with. You know, there was a great Chicago scene. I'm not sure why. I think Chicago, and maybe you've had this experience too, just as a rock and roll musician going through Chicago, it's such a big city, but it's not one of the industry it's not Nashville, LA, New York.
Right.
So you don't have all the trappings of industry and all that sort of jaded thing that goes along with it, where everybody on the guest list has to be on their phone the whole time or whatever.
Right.
Chicago just loves rock. They love it so much.
Yeah.
And there were so many great bands. I remember from Chicago at the time, Freakwater was one that I really loved, and those records hold up for sure. I mean, God, there's a lot. I don't know if I could do them justice now. Old Paint is the Freakwater record, if you're going to go backwards with that band.
That's a great record. Tell me about recording with Waylon Jennings.
Oh, yeah.
What was that? Was that like a posthumous thing? Like, were those old tracks that he had? Did you actually work on?
We went with him. It was, we were on Bloodshot and in the process of signing to Elektra. We had gone to play at the R&R convention in Atlanta or someplace. And so they'd put us, and this was, you know, the old 97 circa early mid 90s, in a hotel ballroom on one of those little flat stages with, you know, folding chairs in front of us. It was just not, it's still weird for, like,
we, those type of events.
I know. Like, we played the Fillmore last night, and it's one of my favorite venues in America.
Yeah.
But there's still something about, like, our band is engineered for us like a bar, like a smoky, dank, low-ceilinged bar where the audience, you're not, you know, the level of the audience's heads isn't my feet.
Right.
It's more like maybe my crotch.
I would argue that all rock and roll is actually best served in exactly the environment you just described.
Yeah.
Maybe up to the size of a theater.
Yeah.
But when you get beyond that, it sort of becomes this other thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I say that as somebody who goes out and plays those kind of big festivals and festival type shows, and it's, you know, it's great, but it's like, it becomes this big, you know, spectacle, and it's not the same thing. You know, it's really, ideally, you're in a bar.
Yeah.
You're right. And crotch level. There's exactly something, you know, connected to that.
So, we were in a bright, you know, meeting, whatever, banquet hall at a stupid hotel. And who's in the front row center but Waylon Jennings? And you know, here's our band named after Johnny Cash. He'd played bass in the Crickets with Buddy Holly, who, you know, is my hero. And at the time, I still had my Buddy Holly glasses going. I've since gotten LASIK surgery. But and we did our thing. We just did what we do. And I could see him. I'd check him out between songs. I tried not to look at him because it was freaking me out. But I'd check him out between songs, and he was just like nodding his head. And at one point, we got to a lyric in Big Brown Eyes that I do a lot of little Easter eggs in lyrics to, just because it's fun for me. But there was a lyric that references a song that I knew from the Kingston Trio but was also popular with the Carter from the Carter family called Worried Man, mm-hmm. Worried Man Blues. Yeah. And so there's a lyric in Big Brown Eyes that takes a worried man to sing a worried song. And when we got to that lyric, he kind of did that, like, my head is blown thing. And he stood up and he, like, looked around at the audience like, are you guys getting this? And it was, like, such a funny moment. And then so after the show, he came over and we got introduced, and he was super nice. And I thought that would be it. But then the next week he went to Austin and gave a big interview in the Chronicle and said, I've seen the future of music and it's the old 97s.
Really?
And I was, so I wrote him a letter and I'm like, dude, we love you.
Is that still in your bio?
Yeah, right. Like, we love, if there's a bio, there's, remember back when there were band bios?
Yeah.
He's like, so I wrote him a letter. I said, we love you if you ever want to do anything. And it coincided with him trying to figure out what he wanted to do for his next record. And he was thinking he might find a young band and make a rock record where the band would back him up. And so as sort of a trial, he brought us into Nashville and picked out two of our songs. Well, he picked out one of our songs, and then Murray wrote a song special for him, which was really sweet, mm-hmm. this Hobo's Lament kind of song. And so we went in the studio with Waylon, and he wanted to start at like 8 a.m. And I was like, are you? So like we compromised, and we started at like 9.
Right.
And his son Shooter was there, and Shooter was like a little like 14-year-old kid with a nine-inch nail shirt on. And,
right.
And Waylon was super sweet and couldn't have been more just pro and nice and regular and,
didn't
talk down to us and didn't act weird. The really funny story that I actually put in the liner notes when this thing finally came out just a couple of years ago was he couldn't pronounce the word elixir. Like, he kept saying Excelsior. And so the band was looking at me like, you got to go in the vocal booth and tell him. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, you go in there.
Yeah. So and I'm like, Mr. Jennings, it's pronounced elixir. And he goes, well, what the hell's an elixir? And I said, well, it's like an old-timey word for drug. And he goes, well, you'd think I'd know that. And I said, well, just so on the next take, maybe just make sure it's a elixir. And he said Excelsior again. And so I had to go back in and I said, all right, let's just forget the word elixir. Just use this mnemonic device I thought of. Think of two women and they're in love. And so when you get to the line, prescribe an elixir, just think one of these women is named Annie. Annie licks her. And he goes, ah, you're sick. I like it. And he nailed it. You know, and you can see him on the record. He goes, prescribe an elixir. And it was this beautiful moment where I'm coaching Waylon Jennings through.
That's amazing.
A made-up lesbian scene in a vocal booth. But the sad thing was he got kind of sick right when we were mixing it and coming up with the artwork. We had John Lankford do this beautiful painting of young Waylon with the four of us floating as cherubim around his head. But the problem was he had just gotten sick, and he was in the hospital. And they brought him the Lankford painting and said, so they want you to approve the artwork for the single. And it freaked him out because it looked like he's young and there's angels around his. He was like, he didn't like it.
I ain't dead yet.
Yeah. And so the whole thing kind of got put on hold and wound up being put on hold for years and years, you know. And so we worked with Shooter to put it out, you know, finally just a couple of years ago.
Like, was Waylon Jennings aware that there were all these young bands drawing influence from him that weren't, you know, like outside of the mainstream country music world, like all these sort of rock and rollers and punk rockers and country bands or whatever, you know?
I think he was starting to feel it. I mean, I think it was that kind of thing, like being at that R&R convention when there were bands that were suddenly. And I guess, you know, you can look at Uncle Tupelo had been doing stuff like this for a few years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there was in L.A., there was that kind of cool movement of the Long Riders and like those kind of bands that were sort of, even X, you can look as, you know, was a precursor to what they called alt country later on. But I think he was starting to figure it out. I really wish now that he could be around to see like the Sturgill Simpson thing and all these things.
That would just blow his mind.
Oh my God, the straight line between him and Waylon is so obvious, and I think it would make Waylon pretty happy to see that.
Yeah, I'm
how
sure.
big it is.
Touring in America has changed a lot, like the landscape of it. And I don't mean so much venues and that sort of side of it, but just the actual like physical like getting off the freeway.
Yeah.
And every town looks the same, and everywhere you go, it's the same. I mean, what's your sense of that? Because it seems to me like Texas was one of the first places that I feel like I saw the sort of hipsterization of things, like way back before it was a thing. You know what I mean? I mean, did that whole thing kind of start there? I mean, I don't even know what this question is
exactly.
But you know what I mean? Like now you get off the, like everywhere you go is the same thing. And it wasn't really like that as much when I first started touring and you started touring before me. So I'm just wondering what your perspective on that is.
You know, when I was in high school, I read the Marshall McLuhan book, The Medium is the Massage, which he was sort of a media philosopher in the 50s and 60s. And one of the things he talked about in the book is sort of the global village, the idea that all regionality will be washed out. And you could start to see it in the 50s. And in the dressing room at Largo, in the bathroom there, there's a great Crumb cartoon thing that shows this one street corner in middle America. And it's first it's Fields, and then it's Fields with a Five and Dime, and then it's Fields with a gas station, and then it's Fields with more buildings and more buildings. And then by the end, it's just shopping centers and generic America. And so people have been seeing that coming for a long time.
But now we're on the other side of that, where shopping malls are like, now those are dying.
Yeah.
You know, it's
isn't
like,
that
it's
crazy?
Gone, and then now that's all starting to fail. It's bizarre to sort of witness this thing firsthand. You know, I interviewed Merle Haggard recently, and he said a great thing, which I thought it was, he said, you know, for those of us that lived through like, you know, the 40s into the 50s and 60s and all that prosperity and everything becoming a little more equal and a little better, because it's real hard to watch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I had my Uber driver on the way here was this really chatty woman, and she was just talking, but it was funny. It was making me laugh. She kept saying, I wonder what it's going to be like for our kids in 100 years, you know, in 3015. And I'm like, that's 1,000. And then she goes, oh, wait, that's 1,000 years. And then she's trying to do the math. Like, what would 100 years?
It's going to be really old, but what's it going to be like for them?
But it did make me think. I'm driving down Melrose, and I'm thinking, like, will it all – because I started coming to Melrose when I was just a little, like, 13-year-old kid. I had a friend out here named Dorothy Moneymaker. There was this beautiful girl. My mom worked for American Airlines, so I flew for free, and I'd fly out and visit her. And her brothers were all in the punk rock scene. And so I got to see L.A. in the 80s, and I got to see that Melrose thing with all the motorcycle boots and all the kind of proto-goth stuff. And
that was my Melrose.
Yeah, right? And I got to go to that club Scream, that big sprawl. I got to see a Jane's Addiction show right when the first record came out on XXX on cassette.
Nice. Yeah.
I bought it on cassette.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, I'm thinking like, this will always be like this.
Right.
But then I'm thinking, but it won't, you know, because nothing's always like anything. And I really hope it doesn't devolve into that zombie apocalypse wasteland that fiction would have us believe it's headed towards. And I don't think it will. I believe in the innate goodness of humanity. And I think that if it devolves, it will devolve into fields full of flowers or something sweet. You know, give me that, please,
right.
Instead of rubble.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, like, I have no issue with the sort of modern hipster trend of like taking over crumbling cities and making a nice restaurant farm to table, or, you know, all that sort of silly stuff that we make fun of, artisanal,
I love that
curated
stuff.
Whatever, yeah. You know, it's silly.
Milwaukee is great,
nice,
like,
you know?
That
yeah
I mean, and you see what they're doing now with Detroit, how that's the new thing. Hipsters are coming in and taking it over, and that's great, because all around Detroit, guess what, there is tons of farmland,
right?
And they can just grow a bunch of stuff, bring it in. There's too many people, you know, so
I read a crazy
why
article
not?
A while ago, it was a couple of years ago, that Detroit was actually being reclaimed by nature, like all that, you know, formal, and like it's basically reverting back, you know.
I love
that's
that.
It's nuts, yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, victory for nature. Do you like touring still? Were you one of those people when you were first starting out that was like, I got to get on the road?
Yeah, I for sure. I've always loved touring. I love the daily challenge of it. I love the feeling of rolling in. I feel like I'm in an army, like this little army, and we're going to go take over this town, and then the next town. It makes it hard when you have kids, and you miss your kids so bad, and you miss things in their lives, you know. And And I had one season of my son's baseball where I was able to be an assistant coach and there for most of the games. That was one, the one season, and that was great. But that, you know, what did it cost my career? You know, and right. And it's, for me, it's been a lot of that. It's like a lot of how hard can I push? Like if I honestly, if I really was driven in the way that some of my peers are driven, I would never have left LA. I would be out here working it and working it and working it. And I'd be trying to score movies and writing songs for movies and doing the, I did a few auditions, you know, maybe I do what John Doe did and get into acting as sort of a, you know, in my 40s, now I'm an actor. I get to play the dad in a movie or whatever.
Right.
You know, I just can't, I don't know. I think if I had to balance those things out, I'm going to let my kids win. And if my career suffers a little bit, then so be it. You know, I'll work a little extra to make sure that the content that I create and the stuff I put out in the world is good enough to make up for my not being in LA all the time.
Right.
Whatever.
I mean, do you have other things in your life, hobbies, interests outside of music that you do?
I do.
How could you possibly? I guess with your tour schedule.
I love it. I love writing. I've been writing a lot. I had a nice piece published. I published a piece in Sports Illustrated last year. I've been writing book reviews for the big coffee table literary magazine Book Forum.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm sort of their, I don't know if I'm their go-to guy, but I'm somebody they reach out to when they want. Like, I reviewed a Bob Dylan biography and an Elliott Smith biography. And
do you have any good literary recommendations for our listening public?
Right.
What would you recommend?
Well, Michael Chabon, the writer I had lunch with yesterday, has a great body of work that, I mean, but he's not like underground. He won a freaking Pulitzer. Right now, I really love genre fiction, which is to say like mystery novels. And right now I'm reading this. I'm so obsessed with it. I'm on the 17th book of the series, and I started like a month ago. My friend Ben Acker, who writes The Thrilling Adventure Hour, is a genius, and he got me into this. Guy, Donald Westlake is a mystery writer, and he wrote under a few other names, and one of the pseudonyms was Jim Stark, and he wrote a series about a thief named Parker, and some of the books have been made into a movie. In fact, I just think one of the books has been made into a couple of different movies. Mel Gibson's Payback, which supposedly the best thing Mel Gibson ever did. I haven't seen it. And there's another movie called Parker. But so this series of books about this thief Parker, who's one of the original sort of anti-heroes, and he's not likable. But the books are so well written.
How many are in the series if you're on book 17?
He wrote like 17 books from the 60s into the 70s. And then he took like 20 years off. And then starting in the 90s, he picked the series up again and wrote a few more till he died in like 2000. Mm. But I haven't gotten to the latter stages, the 90s books. I'm on the final book of the first wave. And I'm thinking after I finish this one, and this is my OCD, I had to read those.
Right.
I had to read all of them in order. And now that I'm hitting that book, I'm going to take a break, just like he did. I'm going to give myself a break from Parker, and I'll come back to it. I don't think I'll take a 20-year break, but I got to stop. I've been so obsessive about these books.
It's funny, man. Sometimes when you're reading something that, you know, every now and again you read one of those books that just, it just like takes you over.
Yeah.
And then you're so fucked up when it ends.
Yeah.
I just went through that when I read that book, The Road. I'd never read it.
Oh, Cormac McCarthy. Yeah, great book.
And as a parent, you're
so dark.
I mean, yeah, it's like by the end of it, I was just in my bunk on tour crying at like 2 in the morning.
You know, that was a Janine Garofalo recommendation years ago.
Oh, really?
And it was so, and then I started asking around, and I have a number of comedy friends, and this is the sad clown cliche being proven true, a number of comedy friends who that's their favorite book.
Right.
And then I finally read it, and I'm like, are you crazy? How can you make comedy and then see this dark place?
Yeah.
But I think that's so much of where comedy comes from, is that really dark place.
The movie version was actually surprisingly good, too.
I haven't seen it because I'm afraid to see it, but maybe I will.
It won't let you down.
Okay,
Viggo.
Good.
Viggo, he's always good. Even if the movie's not good, he's good.
Yeah, got to trust a guy that was married to Exene.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when I first moved to, I live out on the West Side. Uh-huh. And when I first moved there in 2002, Exene lived across the street from me.
Oh, no way.
I swear to God. And I was so pumped. I was like, I'm going to be fucking friends with Exene. Random names with Exene. That never happened.
Yeah.
I would like, you know, see her taking her trash can. I said, hey, you want to come to our kid's birthday party? And she's kind of, you know, nothing. But every now and again, Viggo would pull up to pick up their son.
Yeah.
And my wife would like, you know, throw on her cutest little dress and run out to the front yard. Hey, Bo, hey, how are you?
That's so funny.
Yeah. You know, with your own writing, I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about like your process. You know, I know it's such a cliche thing.
No, I love it.
But like, do you have a specific kind of, you know, discipline to what you do, or is it just sort of however the, you know, however it hits you?
It's more of the latter. I mean, I think that the discipline comes in just doing it, even if the voices in your head that we're talking about are telling you that you shouldn't, that, you know, nobody wants to hear what you say. Like, there's this one voice in my head that keeps saying, isn't it enough? Haven't you made enough? I mean, really?
Right.
That you really think they need another record from you? And that's a tough one, because it's hard to argue with that point. Like, there is a lot.
Yeah.
So, but I know I've had to learn to do it anywhere and everywhere. And it's funny, it used to really be tied up with booze for me and like late nights, and I gotta stay up late and I gotta be a certain level of drunk, not too drunk, just, you know, and that's no longer the case for me. I'm actually taking a break right now from the booze and the weed and just letting it, just living, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, but I've found that it doesn't really have to do with where I am or, you know, what part of the I remember talking to Lucinda Williams at one point, and she's like, well, I got to go write a record. And I'm thinking like, whoa, what are you talking about? You mean you're not always writing?
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't think of writing a record. Like, to me, these songs, they're responses to something. Like, there's something in me that's building up, and I do go to therapy, but there's things that therapy can't touch, you know, and they're weirder and deeper, and that's what the songs are for. And I write, like, there's the first song on the most recent 97s record is one that I'm really proud of. It's a long autobiographical. These are all things that I've avoided my whole career, but I broke all the rules. I wrote something really long and really self-referential and really...
And you say that in the track.
In the song, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And
you also say that, and that's why I asked you about touring, that you, something about, there's a line in there about...
The open road's the only place for me. Yeah. And I love it. It's true. And so, but so I wrote that on an airplane. I just, and for me, it was just rhymed couplets. It was Dr. Seuss. It was, and then I sit down when I finally get a guitar, and the song sort of lets me know where it wants to go. But, you know, sometimes it's a little melody that I can't get out of my head, and then that becomes lyrics. And I've tried not to have rules. I've gotten really good at writing in the back lounge with a bunch of dudes around, or in my kitchen table with the kids running through the house. Just anywhere and everywhere. If I have an idea, I have to do it justice by trying to let it live, you know.
I wondered if that song in particular was, I mean, you said Dr. Seuss, but I was wondering if it was sort of influenced by hip hop. It almost felt like, I mean, not that you're rapping it, but felt like that kind of thing. Like, you know, I was standing on the corner just a waste of my time.
Yeah.
That whole kind of thing.
I've got a new song that I just finished that is so influenced specifically by as I don't really know hip hop super well. I've got friends that have tried to turn me onto it over the years. There's something about the attitude of it, the really kind of aggressive, angry thing that rubs me the wrong way, a lot of it. But there was one song from the 80s that I could never get out of my head where the dude goes, I wish I was a little bit taller. I wish I was a baller. I wish I had a girl with a phone and I'd call her. And I really loved that triple rhyme with the different number of syllables per line. Like, there's something so syncopated but yet repetitive. And so I've got this new song that is, and I'm hoping he doesn't sue me. I don't think he can, because the melody's different, but it's got the, what is it? The third verse is the one that's the most direct of a ripoff. I wish I was a little bit bolder. I wish I was older. I wish I'd got the nerve up and already told her. So I think about hip hop, and I really appreciate the language, the richness of the language. You know, poetry at one point, like 100 years ago, was a legitimate art form that you could do without being a loser. I hate to say that. I'm sure there's people that do poetry that are great.
Right.
But right now, you just feel like, what am I going to go like tell a girl at a bar? What do you do? Oh, I'm a poet. Oh, that's great. Good luck with that. See ya. But I've always kind of liked that idea of poetry, you know, lyrics and words and the richness of language. And so, you know, I figured out a way to do it and get away with it by making it songs.
Yeah.
And, but I still think about it as poetry. I still think about it as language.
Are songs like Nashville autobiographical, or are most of your lyrics autobiographical? Do you pull from your own life letter? Are you sort of writing? Is it almost like fiction?
it's both. Like, I try and filter everything through a narrative voice where I can disclaim it right. to the wife, to the reporter, to anybody.
That's a tough one.
Yeah. But you have to be able to write. Richard Edwards, who sings for Margo and the Nuclear So-and-Sos, is, God, you talk about underrated songwriters. To me, this guy is one of the best voices, both literally his voice, but also his lyrics. He had a line where I was asking him about their most recent record a couple of years ago, Slingshot to Heaven. And it's this crazy record. And, you know, and I know his wife, and she's really sweet and beautiful. And the thing that bothers me when people do it, I did it to him. I'm like, dude, these songs are crazy, and there's stuff going on that makes me worry about you. And he's like, just their songs. You know, and it's like, it's
well,
me.
That's a funny thing. You know, you're saying you were hanging out with some writers. I feel like in rock and roll, everybody's expected to be telling the truth about their life. You know, even if you were a writer, there would be no expectation of that. It would just be taken as literature, you know?
But I think in both cases, you are supposed to tell the truth, and it won't work unless you are telling the truth.
Right.
But, like, it's funny.
Well,
that's
of course, you're going to draw from your experience, but it can be a story that was not your
The names and places have been changed to protect the not-so-innocent. Yeah. But, yeah, Nashville was they put me together with this writer in Nashville, and I walked in, and he said, you know, I got this idea for a song, and he had the chorus, you know, who I got to blow to get in this fucking show, and it's
a great tune. I love
it. Thanks, and I really liked that idea, and so I came up with these verses of this guy, and he means to do the right thing, but he just can't, and I feel like that guy, but I didn't have the exact experiences of marrying Caroline and leaving her and having her dad and her brother want to kick my ass, but I did have the experience of feeling like I'm on the outside of something like this. Right. And that's why I called it Nashville. Like, we could never break into the Nashville market. Right. We don't draw flies in that town.
Right.
And we've never gotten to get covered by those artists that live in Nashville.
Right.
And that's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to realize. Like, I admire the music that built this town. And this town couldn't. If I was on fire, they wouldn't piss on me, you know? And so that's sort of, I felt strongly about that song, but I didn't have to live that story.
Yeah. You know, I've got just a couple little nerdy questions I want to ask you, because I am a guitar player.
Yeah, a very good one.
Oh, thank you.
You probably know a lot more about technology or equipment.
Oh, you know, I'm actually not. Like, I've sort of in my old age become more interested in that, but I was like always like kind of afraid of gear when I was younger. And just hope it works, you know.
Yeah,
I was never the guy that had a bunch of boutique-y cool stuff
like the Edge
cool pedals. It just scared me. I'm trying to make up for lost time now, but this isn't a gear question actually. Who played the guitar solo on Wanderlust?
Oh my God! Isn't
so
that
rip? You said you're not a lead guitar player.
No, wouldn't
first
be
off
me.
Wondering if it was you. But
I made that record in Portland with a band called Black Prairie, and it's primarily composed of members of the Decembrists.
Oh, okay.
But then there's two members of Black Prairie that aren't in Decembrists, and one is Annalisa Tornfeld, who's sort of the singer in Black Prairie. This beautiful fiddle playing female vocalist. Yeah. All the female harmonies are her, and I just love her. But then there's this guitar player who's this sort of Portland all-star that nobody really knows outside of, you know, Portland. And his name's John Neufeld, and he plays...
Wait, I know him.
You do?
I met him I met him at a thing years ago in Portland. I know that guy.
Oh, my God, he's so good. And that guitar solo was one take. It was just him. He probably didn't even think twice about it. It's insane.
Yeah.
There's two... On my solo records, there's two guitar solos that I would hold up with any guitar solo in the world. And one is that Wanderlust, and one is John Bryan on Our Love.
Okay, look.
Were you going to ask that? You got it written
down?
That was
my next question. Yeah. Who played the guitar solo on Our Love? Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, the main thing I want to know is he playing a B-bender on it with all those bends?
It's not a B-bender. What he's doing, and I'm going to forget, is it Chet Atkins? Somebody developed it in 2001, too, when we made that record. John was obsessed with this one guitar style, and it's where you pick up a string, or you bend a string, and you pick up the string above it, and then you bend back down while holding onto the string you picked up, so you're simultaneously bending the one string down and the one string up. So you're with your fingers creating the effect that a B bender would create.
Right.
It's incredible.
It's mind-bending.
Yeah, And he was, and I don't know how much he still does that, but at the time it was something he was really focusing on. So that guitar solo is almost unplayable for a normal human being.
I've never sat down and tried to figure it out, but every time I listen to it, I always go, God, I gotta sit down and try to figure
it out. Yeah. That's funny. That's Rami, your bandmate. That's what he's a big fan, I guess, of that record. And so we come back to that a lot. He'll always pick my brain about that.
And yeah.
He's been really sweet. He's gotten up on stage with me a lot doing songs off that record.
Rami's the best. I love him. Well, thank you for coming and doing this today, man. I really appreciate it. I know it's sometimes it's tough in the middle of the road.
Thanks for taking the time out of your one day at home.
Yeah. Well, now I can rush home, see my kiddies after school.
Yeah, pick them up.
Yeah. All right, that was Rhett Miller here on Walking the Floor, and you heard it here first. That was him explaining John Bryan's secret string bending technique. So try that at home, kids. Please, try that at home. I know I'm gonna. If you like what you heard today, make sure you go to rhettmiller.com or old97s.com and check out where in this crazy world Rhett Miller is on tour. Check out his albums. Check out whatever he's up to. And while you're at it, go to walkinthefloor.com and you can stream all the old interviews we've done. They're all up there, or you can pick us up in the iTunes store. So that's it for this week. We'll see you soon. Adios, amigos.